Damn, let's talk some shit.
It's Polly Siegel.
And Victoria Aaron.
Two licensed therapists who've spent way too much money on degrees, certifications, and trainings. Mm. We both love what we do and couldn't imagine working in any other profession. But we're forced to be serious all the time, and that gets boring. Shit Talking Shrinks discusses important mental health topics, the human experience, and society at large, while poking fun along the way. It won't be all fun and games, because after every episode, you'll walk away with tangible tools to navigate life more effectively.
We love a tangible tool.
This episode is sponsored by Joyous.
Okay, I have to tell you about this incredible company, Joyous. It's an at-home ketamine treatment that delivers ketamine to your door for $129 a month, which is absolutely unheard of because most ketamine treatment is hella expensive. And what ketamine does is it helps our prefrontal cortex work more optimally. And the prefrontal cortex helps with decision-making, problem-solving, emotional regulation. It's the part of the brain that gets us through hard shit. And so if you're someone who has struggled with anxiety and depression and you've tried antidepressants or you've tried mood stabilizers and they haven't helped, ketamine is absolutely the next step. And I have seen my clients thrive while using ketamine. Joyous makes it super easy to access this life-changing medicine, and you can start the process by visiting www.joyous.team. Hello, everyone. We have the most incredible guest today. I am a really big fan of you, Stan, and I'm like, my heart is so deeply grateful for the opportunity to get to chat with you and discuss. And we are sad that we don't have Victoria here today. She was dealing with some personal issues, but is with us in spirit. So we have Stan here today, and Stan is the best-selling author. He's a therapist, a researcher, and the developer of the PACT Institute, which is such a profound model and intervention for couples and has made such a difference in the, you know, couples marriage community. So it's such an honor.
Thank you for having me.
Today, we're discussing attachment styles. And obviously, that's a huge buzz in the world. Lots of people are interested in knowing their own attachment styles, learning their partner styles. You know, it's been such a hot topic for a while. But I think one of the biggest deficits in the discussion is that people don't really understand the formation or the origin of how their attachment style came to be or the why behind their attachment style. And so I'm really hoping that we can discuss that and process that together around really how that came to be.
So attachment is basically a measure of safety and security, both in infant and a child, in adolescent and an adult. It's not about love. It's not a personality formation. It is an adaptation to one's, say, family culture, the way the family operates, which is handed down from generation to generation. And we could think of it as either a hyper focus on the self as a parenting style or a focus on relationship. We might think of secure attachment. The culture focuses on relationship more than the self, more than performance, more than appearance. No matter what, your relationship with me is more important than your achievements, even though I do have high expectations of you, but I also provide a lot of support. Let's go left of center there. Let me also say that in secure attachment, the parent or caregiver is consistent, is resourced internally and externally, so is able to focus on the infant, be present, attentive over long spans of time, be able to be face to face, eye to eye, skin to skin, and to be curious. We expect that a caregiver has a theory of mind, the ability to be curious about their own mind, which extends to then to the baby, curious about the baby's mind, and is locating the baby constantly by making errors. So I'm attuning to you, and then I misattune, and then I reattune, and then I misattune, then I reattune, right? So my responsibility to find you, not for you to find me. And so in the first year, we have a saying, first year, the baby leads and the caregiver follows. then you can't tell who's leading and following once that dyad begins to interact. So those are the conditions. I'm interested in you. I have patience. I'm able to locate you again and again and again as necessary. That is a necessary condition for secure attachment.
You know, a caregiver that creates an environment that's dependable and reliable in that child in infancy, you know, through time, their needs are met. Maybe not perfectly, but on more often than not, their emotional, their psychological, their physical, cognitive, spiritual needs are met in the process of development. Is that accurate?
Yes. Although you might think of the environment as the intersubjective field between caregiver and baby. So it is the relationship that is the environment here. The environment could be chaotic, but if the relationship is consistent, if the relationship is felt by the infant, we can see behaviors that show otherwise, felt by the infant to be safe and secure, then that supersedes any other aspects in the environment that are maybe not calm, maybe not consistent.
So that's really fascinating. So like the environment could be chaotic or disruptive, but as long as the energetic connection between caregiver and child has stability and dependability and that reliability, that can still produce secure attachment.
Yes. Otherwise, we wouldn't have people from war-torn areas, children raised during that time, end up being secure. Why are they secure? They may have PTSD, but they're secure because of their relationship bond with their most important primary attachment figures. So that insulates the infant, insulates the child. So otherwise, we'd all be, anybody in Ukraine now would be insecure. We know that's not so. So the environment here is the relational orbit of the primary figures, right? The caregiver and the infant.
It's fascinating because I hear so often, you know, people believing that attachment style has equally as much to do with the environment and that it must have been this calm, peaceful, non-chaotic atmosphere. But just from what you said, that doesn't need to be the case. I think that's a really important point.
You have secure attachment in Mediterranean countries where people, it's common that the family members yell at each other all the time. They're not traumatized by it.
Right.
Because it is not deemed as unsafe. It's not a dangerous environment to somebody who came from a very quiet, maybe milquetoast family would find it alarming. But if you are raised in that and there are enough signs of love and making amends and connection, you know, kids acclimate. And again, this is the felt sense of the infant. There are things at work here that are phenomenological that can't be explained away simply by the caregiver. For instance, the internal systems, biology of the infant. Let's say an infant is constantly in pain or some other malady. The baby can't be calmed, and this can cause certain problems. The caregiver, no fault of their own, is dealing with a baby that is in pain. And so, you know, Melanie Klein, going back to Melanie Klein, would consider this a problem where the infant is feeling persecuted by internal sensations, right, that are painful, and then will blame the object, whether it's the breast or the whole person, right, because there's no separation between object and self. That aside, we don't know exactly, although Daniel Stern did quite a bit through digital frame analysis, of studying what it is from the infant's point of view, the first time that had been done, what it would be like to be the infant, what that world would be like if one put themselves in that infant's place. You know, we constantly try to understand what it feels like to be the infant through all different measures, all different means, but there's, you know, will we ever really know? I don't know. So secure attachment is measured thus far by the interactions between the infant and the caregiver as captured by the strange situation. Ainsworth developed that. It's still in existence today. That's done between 10 and 18 months. After 18 months, it's no longer valid. Before 10 months, it's not valid. So between that time, we're able to measure by watching and coding the infant's behaviors while under stress in this strange situation. People can look at YouTube to see what that's like. But it focuses on the infant, doesn't focus so much on the caregiver, except for the caregiver's behaviors that seem to trigger certain behaviors in the infant. So that's that. So what's insecure? Insecure is not feeling that the infant has a secure base because of the way the culture stretches the infant to give up either their dependency needs or their needs for autonomy, depending on the age of the child. If you have a parent or a caregiver or caregivers that are themselves insecurely attached, they're anxious in a sense of feeling dependent and clingy, and they have a hard time with separations and reunions. They have a hard time with frustration tolerance, these caregivers. They have a hard time with being able to regulate themselves under stress and distress. And they often will use the child's need for dependency to serve their own needs. And they'll encourage the child to stay close, not go out into the non-caregiver environment. They will encourage them to stay young, cute, and dependent. But because of their problems with self-regulation, they will alternate between a need to cling and a need to distance. Therefore, because the caregiver is preoccupied with their life and often overwhelmed, they get frustrated with the clinging behaviors they themselves have encouraged with the baby. So the baby now is seeking attention and they feel they're too much. The baby begins to get this alternating experience of come here, go away. Come here, I love you. I love that you're so sweet and that you are here with me and you're bothering me. You're too much, go away. And this alternation leads to an ambivalence and an anger and also an apprehension to take risks. So the baby starts to cling, doesn't go out into the environment as much, gives up their need for autonomy in exchange to stay there with the caregiver, only to find that it feels like they're later in life being used, that I have to take care of this person and I don't know how to take care of myself. I have to take care of this person and I have to be careful. I can't demand anything. I can't ask for what I want because my hopes will be dashed. I'll get rejected. I'm very, very sensitive to any signs of withdrawal and rejection. And I also feel like I get punished a lot for needing and wanting you. And that punishment is something that remains as a behavioral defense in me as that person. I seek out relationships. I'm very relational, but as soon as I capture someone, I become ambivalent and I'm not so sure that I want to be with this person. I start to remember what it's like. I'll be rejected. They'll fall out of love with me. They won't want me. And I'll look for every bit of evidence to prove this is true. You're not looking at me. You'd rather be with that person. Tell me you love me. You don't tell me you love me. Why don't you tell me you love me? I'm always testing to see, because I won't take a risk. I won't claim what's mine because that would put me in danger. I'm ill-equipped to being an autonomous, individuated person that thinks for myself and is able to separate. And so the beat goes on. I start to protect myself from what I know will happen, even though this is predictable and it's not intended to send people away. It is viewed by another person as threatening.
And are you highlighting anxious attachment?
Anxious on both sides. So anything that is not secure is by definition anxious, right? I am anxious about being abandoned. I'm anxious about being engulfed and having my freedoms taken from me. But in this case, we're talking about the anxious, ambivalent, or the angry, resistant individual, or as I started calling them, waves, to stay with a nautical, non-pathologic sounding term, right? Waves. So waves are clingy and they fear most being rejected, being withdrawn from, being abandoned. And yet these people also kind of create their own abandonment by being very negativistic. In other words, I protect myself by assuming the worst and I act on it, which basically is a vote of no confidence to you. It's annoying. It's hostile. And it actually makes you move back from me, which is the thing I fear most. That's the clinging side in general, the clinging side of insecure attachment. Yeah.
So something that I hear often in my clinical practice, like someone has, you know, has read Amir Levine's book and they've done different assessments and they've identified, okay, I have anxious attachment.
This is a research model. And I regret in some ways, like I said, I'm doing a revision of Wired for Love. I do regret in some ways coming up with Island Anchor Wave, even though it mimics and basically is the same as the more clinical terms of anxious attachment, right? But it's a research model. Therefore, it's not intended for consumers to use because it will be misunderstood and will be used as a cudgel, often against partners that people find difficult or against themselves. And so it's not an accurate way to go about doing it. And also, I just want to remind people, attachment is fluid. It's not like personality. It's not etched in stone. It changes and can change with any primary attachment relationship. And it's also a set of memories that pop up as soon as I feel like I'm depending on someone, or as soon as I start to feel that they're permanent, I start to remember what happens when I depend on somebody. And then I employ a set of defenses to protect myself. That's actually all it is. Once somebody understands what they're afraid of, then they can start to harness their tendencies to do things that feel unfair or unjust or insensitive to another person. So that's the purpose of knowing about yourself. The purpose of knowing who your partner might be or what they might be, how they might be organized in this way, is to know how to work with them, not to beat them up and not to just call them names. So that's where I worry about this thing. When the public gets a hold of research models and categorizations that are used for medicine, psychiatry, psychology, it's an ugly thing.
Well, and also what has happened is that, you know, avoidant attachment has been villainized. And I think that's what you're sort of speaking to, is that by using a research model, it's been, you know, villainized and demonized to be the bad attachment style, or to be, you know, the asshole attachment style. And I think that's inherently problematic.
If you're a human primate, you're an asshole. Let's face it. It's species wide. It's not a category. It is our species. We're assholes. And it's important to know that and own that so that we can put guardrails up to prevent us from doing bad things in relationship. Doesn't matter whether you're an island wave or frog or a goat. You still have to work collaboratively and cooperatively with another person if you want that relationship to exist over time. There is no good or bad, right or wrong with attachment. This is an adaptation to environment. It's nature at its best. It's not pathologic. It's just annoying. It's just difficult in a primary attachment relationship. That's all.
One thing that I see a lot is, you know, as someone identifies as having anxious attachment, and then they start interacting with different suitors. And when they interact with someone who's available and leans in and is wholehearted, there's this like intense withdrawal. Could you speak more to that? Because as I understand anxious attachment, right, it's this desire to really be embraced and loved, and you want to feel connected. You want to feel attached. But when that's given to you, why is there that, like, oh God, I'm being like suffocated here? I find that a little like an oxymoron.
Well, not really, if you understand the origins. So let's talk about the distancing group on the distancing side of the spectrum. And since we're talking to therapists, I like clinging groups and distancing groups because we could put a lot of personalities as well in those buckets, because there's some similarities between personality formation and disorders of the self and attachment organization. There are a lot of similarities. And so if we group them by distancing defense and clinging defense, I think it's an easier way to understand a whole lot of people. So on the distancing side, I was raised by a family, let's say, that also distancing, which means they weren't raised with attachment values of a longing, face-to-face curiosity, eye-to-eye, skin-to-skin for long periods, wanting to know you. There's a lot of emphasis on the self first, self-esteem, ownership, power, youth, and beauty, Performance is often a feature in the distancing group. Emphasis on performance, emphasis on appearances, how we look to the outside, or appearance as in vanity. And so there's much more emphasis on don't be a bother, don't be needy. We don't do needy in this house. We dismiss neediness, clinginess as a problem, as something shameful. So very early, infants learn to stop proximity seeking. We see this over and over and over again with these babies. The caregiver no longer uses proximity or never does use proximity seeking. And so it gets extinguished in the baby. All these behaviors to depend, cling, which is appropriate very early in life, are sort of snuffed out. The baby begins to adapt to what the rules and regs of this culture really are. I begin to spend a lot of time alone. I don't have a lot of interaction. Therefore, I begin to over-rely on a self-care strategy, something called auto-regulation, which is normal. We all do it. If I am an island or an avoidant, I do it way too much because that's all I could do. And so I self-soothe and I self-excite, stimulate without a person. In fact, people become overly stressful for me. So I get into these fantasy states, these sort of dissociative states of hyper-focus, play, imagination. And because the mind is not Disneyland, and I'm being neglected on an attachment level, I'm more exposed to fear and anger and temperamental issues, right? I can also become more aggressive, but I am conflict avoidant. I am passive aggressive. I tend to keep secrets. This is all normal, given that trajectory. I compartmentalize. I come up with things that may not be socially acceptable when I go through psychosexual stages and so on, and polymorphously perverse, as Freud would put it. And so I don't feel secure. My caregivers don't really want me. They need me for something. I feel used, and that I resent. I resent being intruded upon when I have now learned to take care of myself, and you wake me up as if from out of a dream. You're intruding on my state, which is groovy. You want something from me, and I know it's not for me. It's for you.
So it's almost like you start to perceive any sort of attachment or dependency as a threat. It's threatening your autonomy and your independence.
There's threat on both sides, but the threat is different. One side is abandonment and rejection. This side is you're taking things from me, my autonomy. You're using me, my independence. You want my stuff. You don't want me. You need me. You know, fuck that. I'm out the door. So I don't have a way to engage with you. I have only one defense, and that's to flee. I can't be myself in this tight orbit. I can only be myself outside the orbit. And therefore, I tend to seek other objects outside, which makes you look like you're not enough. But that is not necessarily the case. I'm threatened by you. I need to get out in order to feel like I can breathe again. I forget that I made this choice. Now I'm plagued by, it's an internal thing, but it's also played out externally. Someone who is always making demands of me. I have to perform. It's always for them, never for me. I can't be myself. I can't have boundaries. I can't engage. Here's another thing. I also can't feel libidinal with you. So what will commonly happen with this group, not always, but often, with male, female, it's not gender. I will lose my interest sexually in you. I won't be able to perform as soon as we commit. Because of threat, my body shuts down. And there are, in terms of neuroscience, there are certain areas of the brain that are overly inhibiting, overly error correcting, and overly predicting that use up so many resources, I can't perform. And I think I'm just not that into you. However, if we break up, I'm back again, right? So once I have that distance, it's like there's oxygen again for a flame to exist.
It's like oxygen is a penis pump.
Yes, the oxygen is that you don't need me. You're not demanding, expecting anything from me. But even if you didn't, there's a part of me that's telling myself, you are expecting something from me. Everyone expects something from me. So this is a problem in the island's head as it is in the wave's head. It's just externalized, right? Because it's relational. It's relational. I'm in a relationship with you. And now it feels like it did with my earliest attachment figures. I'm remembering and it's coming back to me, and you're a dangerous character.
Gosh, that's so powerful. So just to recap for listeners, I'll recap the best I can here. So you'll correct me when I'm off here. You know, when we look at anxious attachment, it tends to form from very unpredictable parents.
No, not unpredictable. No, because unpredictable parents will give rise to disorganized babies. Whenever I hear unpredictable, I start to investigate whether or not the caregivers had unresolved trauma. That is what gives rise to unpredictability. Now, these people are incredibly predictable. Even the wave, I think you're thinking about the wave, you know, come here, go away, is predictable. It's predictably disappointing. It's predictably rejecting, which makes me defend in a predictable way. But if I'm disorganized because I have a frightening parent, a parent that is frightening, unpredictable, creates disorganization in me. The problem for us therapists, if it's really early, that person now is unpredictable. When we're dealing with personality disorders, predictable. When we're dealing with attachment insecurity, predictable. When we're dealing with any kind of unresolved trauma, unpredictable.
Here's where I want clarity is that if a child, you know, sometimes that caregiver is, come here, I love you, and there's warmth. And then there's sometimes, go away, you're annoying, see you later. Wouldn't you describe that as sort of unpredictable to the child? They don't know what to anticipate.
They do by studying the caregiver. So as they go, they become very keyed in to threat, as does the distancing kids, right? So we could think of this as a kind of relational or ambient trauma. Ambient trauma, I think, is Wessel van der Kolk's term. It's in the air. I am an expert on you in a certain way as an infant because I depend on you. I'm starting to read the tea leaves and I start to know what I can and cannot do. And that's the whole point. It's not unpredictable. It's unreliable. And it's because the caregiver is preoccupied continuously with the self. So here again, we have the self is more important than the relationship, but still more important than on the distancing side, which makes the clinging group more relational.
I want to take a quick pause to talk about our sponsor, a company called BetterHelp. It's an online therapy platform where all the therapists are licensed and accredited professionals. It's affordable. You pay a low flat fee for therapy with your therapist, and it's convenient. Do it at your own time and at your own pace, and you can communicate with your therapist as much as you want and whenever you feel is needed. And more importantly, it's effective. Thousands of people have benefited from therapy using BetterHelp, and we're really grateful to offer all of our listeners 10% off your first month. So if you're interested in receiving therapy ASAP, click the link in our show notes and you can get started. And you get to save money. And then you have the subtype of anxious avoidant, meaning both of those strategies and presentations are exhibited within the partnership. Can you speak to that? Like, you know, the book Attached, right, by Amir Levine. In that book, right, they describe secure attachment, anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, and then a very rarer type of anxious avoidant, meaning you're exhibiting both.
If you're avoidant, it's all anxious.
So you don't see it as a separate category?
No.
You know what comes up so often, at least clinically, but also just, I don't know, I'm part of different groups on Facebook of, I'm sure you've heard of these groups where, are we dating the same person? Have you heard of this?
No.
Where people will post like, hey, I went on a date with John Smith. Has anyone else gone on a date with John Smith? What's your experience with John Smith? And then there's just a bunch of people that are commenting, oh yeah, I went out with him in 2011. Here's my experience. It's crazy. But there's so many of these groups on Facebook. And there's one actually in Chicago. And so I joined more for comedic relief, if I'm being honest, just to kind of observe and be a little bit of a researcher in that group.
It's funny, but it's also horrifying. And I can see why it's going to be more and more difficult for people to tolerate others. But anyway, go on.
You know, I joined the group to be the observer and just kind of be a fly on the wall, never participate. it was interesting so much how often, you know, oh, John Smith, well, he's an avoidant, make sure not to go out with him. Or, you know, Tom, he's definitely so clingy and anxious. He was so annoying in the process. And so all these people are starting to form these opinions about people that are truly biased, and they're not able to authentically show up and experience that person in their own, you know, journey. And with that all said, there's a lot of discussion on these groups about, well, he's an avoidant and I'm anxious and I don't know why I keep attracting avoidance and I keep getting stuck in this trap, you know, attracting suitors, the distancers. And I wonder if you could explain, why does that trap happen so frequently where those two people tend to act as magnets?
Ah, vive la différence. It is complementary in the beginning. You know, we used to say that about borderline personality disorders and narcissistic personality disorders famously getting together. Why? Well, with all, you know, pair bonding, there is recognition. I pick by recognition and familiarity. Therefore, nature is not making a mistake. I think I've made a mistake because what I'm looking for was right. What I don't want was also there. And I still don't know how to deal with what I don't know how to deal with. So then now we have a competence issue. I don't know how this damn thing works. I want to send it back. I want a warranty. I want to get rid of it. You know, I thought it was a duck, but it's actually a chicken. This is a more of a fabrication of the mind because we're otherizing. This is one of the features of human primates, our xenophobia, our racism, our otherizing. We do it even in our partnership. Our tendency to compare and contrast is famous. Our awareness of what's missing at all times is famous. It's a feature in hunting and gathering and picking where to pitch a tent. It's a bug in relationship and happiness. We know that part of the human condition is for us to go, I'm unhappy. I don't know why. Oh, yes, it's you. And so this is why not understanding the human condition, forget the categorizations that we are so fond of as humans, because we need to organize our experience, that otherizes, unless it's done clinically or for science or research and so on. There's a purpose for categorizing to figure out what it is I'm looking at. But in the populace, to categorize is otherizing. And so that's what's happening. And the same thing when we pair bond. I'm so in love with you. You're everything I wanted. I'm projecting on you. I'm also on drugs, by the way. I'm on endogenous drugs, which blind my judgment because nature only wants me to fuck you. Nature has no interest, never did, in our long-term relationship.
Yes.
And so I am on all these endogenous love potion drugs, which is why we vet people with our peeps, right? We're supposed to bring them around to the village and have them sniffed out with us, old and young, female, male, everybody, because they have to fit into our fucking culture. Otherwise, they're not going to fit in and we're going to have a really hard time. So there's a reason for that. And a lot of people want to buck that. And that's a mistake. So I'm a big advocate for understanding that a union between two individuals is no different than any other union in a free society. It has to be based on fairness, justice, sensitivity, equal power, equal authority. Two generals working together to create, co-create a new culture of their own, a new architecture of what is home based on what we want, you and I want today. And it's a constant shaping of this thing that does not exist except in our heads, this thing called relationship, which is an abstraction. This is a shared mythology that we made up. We better be making up the same thing or we're going to fight. We're going to have a problem. We better come up with ways to protect each other from ourselves. Otherwise, we're going to do damage because human primates, all of us, are predominantly unreliable, selfish, self-centered, moody, fickle, easily influenced by groups, warlike, aggressive, and xenophobic. What could go wrong?
How do we even have successful couples after you describe all of that?
I think the magic sauce in successful couples is they're not relying on feelings. They're relying on shared purpose. They know how to work together. They know how to deal with each other as pain in the asses, because all people are. They understand that all people are disappointing, annoying, irritating, but they've kept threat and danger out of their relationship by coming up with structures, organization, hierarchy. They understand what they are, why they are, and where they're going. This is essential. And most people are not learning this. Most people do not do this. They would do it in a business. They would do it if they were setting up a temple. If they were doing a rock band, they're doing a dance troupe, they would sure be doing it this way. Otherwise, people would leave. We have a bigger problem here. That is the human condition. That's what I get afraid of. And I'm involved in this. When we're so caught up in categorizing people, otherizing, we forget that we're all assholes. We can be that if we're under enough stress or in enough distress. We all will do similar things that are not pro-social and not friendly. And so it worries me that there's a preoccupation with these categorizations and otherizing people without understanding, you know, we're the same.
So in Shit Talking Shrinks, we're about tangible tools. So if you could give our listeners three tangible tools around how to navigate attachment or connection, we'd love that.
I'd like to go bigger, just in line with my rant, because you got me excited there. Well, because I just started realizing more and more why this upsets me, the focus. If you are not yet in a relationship, write down what your perfect relationship will be, would be with person X. Don't imagine a person, imagine the relationship and a person wanting the same thing that you want and willing to do the same thing to get what you both want. Start with safety and security, right? We tell each other everything. We're fully transparent with each other. Why? Because the left and right hand needs to know the same thing, and we're working as a team. We're an awesome team. We need to know the same things, and discovery's a bitch. We put the relationship first above all things because we're going to be at the top of the food chain, and it's going to be up to us to handle everyone and everything. Therefore, we have to come first, because if we go down, everyone else is screwed, including our kids. You start to think about what would be the guiding principles of this relationship that would make it awesome. Set the bar as high as you want, but it's we, what we will do, not what I will do or what you will do. We do this, right? We show affection, admiration, appreciation for each other each day, every day, the way the other person wants it. That can be done. It shall be done. Do we do it when we're angry with each other? You bet. Because purpose-centered principles have to be done, not based on feeling, because we decided it must be done. We want a bitch in life. So focus on the perfect relationship, not the perfect person, and find out whether these people for real want the same things. Vet your partner around with everyone. Ask your peeps. Look at me. Do you like how I am with this person? Do I see myself? Do you like this person? Do you like us together? Do we seem like the real deal?
Tip number two.
If you're in a relationship, now is the time to start talking with your partner. Did we build this thing together, or are we flying a half-built plane? Did we actually co-create our own relationship, or are we being run by other people and other ideas from far ago? That's most people. We're operating automatically according to our earliest relationships. How are we going to handle each other when we're misbehaving? Let's come up with a principle that we both agree with that will keep each other in line and make it enforceable, with the understanding that when enforced, we both have to cooperate immediately. That is good business. That's assuming that love will not will out, that we're human beings. We're planning on our devils, not our angels. Plan for your devils and put that in place. That's the safety and security system. And then I'll leave you with one other thing. If you're a couple, always think of PEPPER. It's an anagram. Predict, plan, prepare, and be ready to revise every event before you go. Just before you go and take your parents out to dinner, before you have a sit down with your kids, before you go on that trip, before you go to Easter dinner, whatever it is, plan first. You and I are going to have a great time. We come first, other people second. That's how we're going to take care of everyone. We're going to have an awesome time. By the end of that, we're going to high five each other because we did great as a team. Now, we think, what could possibly go wrong? We go one by one and predict each other, and we put things in place to prevent each other from ruining our time. We start to predict drunk Uncle Bob and the brat that always disrupts our kids. We're going to plan and prepare for that so that nobody is harmed. Everyone's taken care of, but we are running the show, even though we're the invitees. So that everywhere we go, we don't walk in unprepared, right? We don't do that.
It's almost like, you know, if you're walking into a fire, you better have your gear and you better be practiced.
Because when you go live, it's going to be a shit show. That's another thing people don't do. They don't predict each other. I walk into the same thing with you every time because I don't predict you and I don't plan of what I'm going to do if you do this. What will I do if you do that? I should know by now. I'm an idiot if I don't, right? I get a dog and every time I approach on the left, I get bit and I keep approaching on the left. Who's the idiot? This is the human condition. We're lazy creatures. We're entitled creatures. We want other people to do what we don't think we should have to do in return. That's the nature of being human. And that's what we got to start to grow up and know and prepare for.
And on that note, we are sending everyone big, big love. Thank you for tuning in and joining us. And we have a new book, In Each Other's Care, that Stan is releasing that I've already signed up to get the free excerpt from. I just can't wait to read another one of your fabulous and impactful books. So if anyone wanted to consume your content, be able to access your magic, what's the best way for people to find you?
Simply go to thepactinstitute.com, P-A-C-T. Institute.com. There you'll find all these couples retreats that my wife and I do together. We have one coming up next year in Portugal, but we do a lot of couples workshops throughout the year. And actually, I started off as a professor. So I teach therapists a psychobiological approach to couple therapy throughout the world. We do it online and it's done regularly. And you can sign up if you're interested in being trained. Other than that, I'm Dr. Stan Tatkin at whatever social media you go to.
Yes. And I will make sure to put his socials and his email, or well, not his email, but the contact information for the Pact Institute, all that good stuff. Thank you again, everyone. We'll catch you later.